Portland is a regional medical college that provides a number of health practitioners and is nationally recognized. It is not supported by this institution.
Thank you, Representative. Representative Johnson.
I will also be voting no, and it brings me no pleasure to do so. I proudly sit on the foundation boards for both OHSU and Dornbecker, and I know the work of this remarkable institution firsthand. Mine is a protest vote to a budget that I think is inadequate. My colleague, Representative Patridge, has summed up many of my concerns. By failing to adequately fund OHSU, we're cutting programs such as the School of Nursing at a time of a critical shortage. We're jeopardizing clinical and research revenue, reducing outreach and community service. And I just think this is the wrong time to do this, so I can't support the budget.
You want to declare a conflict of interest in advance?
Sure.
Senator Dukes.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. I think Representatives Patridge and Johnson said it very well. I will be voting to support the bill. If I thought that my no vote could change things, I would be casting a no vote. Anybody who deals in any degree of health care understands that it's a very high priority for Oregonians, and I think that what we are doing has the real potential of crippling Oregonians' ability to receive those health care services in the future, both for the doctors and for the nurses and dentists that have been previously mentioned. I think that as we go through, money is not loose this session, but our priorities are important, and I think that this should be one of them. So I also want to register a deep concern with this budget.
Thank you, Senator. I'd like to address some of the concerns. I think, as we all know, this is not the only financial request that the university has in this session, and that we're all struggling with trying to find a way to meet a very innovative bonding package request, visionary project that the university, in the spirit of what has made it great, has brought to us. This is not an easy thing to do. We're talking very large dollars. So I don't I don't necessarily disagree with some of the concern and the angst over this specific part of the budget. I think there's a much larger issue that we all have to acknowledge as we go forward here in trying to put forth the best financial funding package that we can for the university. This is not a standalone budget, as I'm sure we're all aware. This is something that will be part of a piece, or a piece of a part, and there's some significant issues still yet to be decided here, and I would encourage the committee to take that into consideration as we cast our votes today. Representative Hanson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have some of the similar concerns as other members. I'll be voting for the budget, but certainly I hope that there are additional pieces directed toward the shortage of medical professionals that may come along later yet.
Mr. Co-Chair.
Representative Winters.
I, too, have a similar concern about the budget. I will support it. As those of you who probably know, I was on Teal Hill from 1959 to 64, and the work that they do on the Hill is one that benefits us all, so I am concerned, but I will support the budget. We do have a nursing crisis in the state, and we have other crises that the med school, I still say med school because of my previous years ago, but I am concerned about the $10 million.
Thank you, Representative. Any other discussion? Senator Butler.
Mr. Chair, just by way of question, there has been some discussion which surrounds the issue of the bond, the $10 million bond, and I feel like I'd like to have just a little more information about if there is any intention to move forward with bonding at this particular time to benefit the institution.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Hill.
Representative Butler, that's a different bill, Senate Bill 832, and those issues are being worked, and it will be moving. So that's the only answer. Is they're meeting Probably be moving on Monday, Tuesday.
The I think it's a very direct answer to your question. You know, we're going to do something. We just don't know exactly what it is yet. It's this very complicated issue involving very large dollars and very significant roll-up for the state. I think we're committed to that. But at what level and what degree and in what form is a different question. So, that, I mean, I think Representative Hill said it best. Senator Troll.
Yeah. I guess as we consider whether or not to vote for the budget, we're concerned about some of the things that have been mentioned in the discussion, especially I think we're concerned about what's going to happen to nurses training and some other professionals, and it would appear as the discussion proceeds that there may be some way of handling that problem, and if we approve the budget, it's going to be taken care of later in some way. But could you be a little more specific and give us some confidence that, because otherwise the tendency might be to vote no for this, because it seems as though it's not quite an adequate budget.
Well, a short version of a very long story is, as probably most of you are aware, in addition to this funding package, the governor proposed in his recommended budget a $200 million bonding authority to be covered by debt service of $10 million this biennium. Well, that's fine as far as it goes, except he backed it with tobacco bonds, for which you cannot issue $200 million worth of indebtedness. Tobacco bonds are extraordinarily expensive based on the risk factor in the market. Now, don't get me wrong, with $10 million worth of issuance authority, or I should say debt service and issuance costs, you could issue $400 million worth of bonds in a given year. The question is what is the sustainability of a $200 million issuance? What will that cost on an ongoing biennial basis? Are they going to be tobacco bonds, which would make that cost upwards of $38, $40 million a biennium? It's a long way from 10. Or can we find a way legislatively or through the initiative process to allow those bonds to be issued as general obligations, which would significantly reduce the cost, cut it in almost half? Those are the issues we're struggling with. I can share with you that as of this Monday, the co-chairs, the Senate President, Speaker of the House, and Dr. Kohler and various representatives from the university will be meeting in the governor's office to try to finally get our arms around this. And I say this, you know, as important as this is and as significant for Oregon's future as this is, I think many on the e-commerce sub, the co-chairs, leadership, the governor, we have all spent a tremendous amount of time dealing with this. We're committed to it. We want to find the proper and appropriate answer. And it is, again, a balance of public policy and what we can afford as we go into future biennials.
Follow-up, how does that relate to the nursing problem? Is there a connection? Because my answer was, you know, we got a nursing problem, and it's not being adequately funded. Does that solve it? If we get that money, will that solve the problem?
Let me let Representative Hill address that question specifically.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The issue of the bonding is capital construction. It's going to be for facilities. There'll be facilities constructed to make sure there are clinical research facilities up on the hill, trying to move probably administrative thing off to the west campus, and then there'll be facilities constructed out in within the state and other areas, not in the Portland Metro region, in support of the research programs. This does not address the nursing issue. The subcommittee did adopt a budget note trying to focus on this in terms of the way we're giving these dollars. This is a block grant dollars, and we adopted a budget note that sort of, you know, had a nice, you know, thing, you know, focus on health care, focus on the teaching, but the decisions and the choices that are going to be made are going to be made by the board of directors of OHSU. And there were several scenarios that were presented to the subcommittee, which are not nice choices. And those choices in under this budget could include the reduction of nursing programs, reducing slots in the nursing program, reducing slots in the dentistry program, reducing slots in the medical school. These are not nice choices. They have other options. One budget note on, regarding nursing said, look at increasing out-of-state tuition as a way to try to make up some of these dollars so you don't have to go and reduce. So there's a range of choices that the board of directors of OHSU is going to have to make. We did not write a budget that was going to be specific and say you're going to first spend your dollars here, here, and here. This was written as a block grant. Go out and fulfill these purposes with these dollars, but here are our priorities that we think that you should focus these dollars on.
Did you reduce the block grant from what the governor had recommended?
No. Because the governor had reduced the grant, the OHSU's grant by $10 million. And so this was at the same level that the governor had recommended. And that $10 million reduction is a significant reduction and will have a profound effect on programs that they can deliver. And this is going to be a challenge that we're going to have to face.
Further comments? Representative Patrick.
I just want to clarify for the record that I think that, unfortunately, the biotech initiative and this cut in the nursing, or the cut in their base grant budget, have been unfortunately tied together. The grant, the biotech initiative is an economic development tool that I think is an important tool for the state of Oregon and should stand on its own. When we talked about this initially, it happens to be $10 million, which also happens to be the cut in the amount of their base grant for the Hill and for the subsidy that the state helped provide to provide training across the state. I think they're two totally separate issues, and just because we're doing the bonding piece does not, or if we do the bonding piece, does not give me comfort that the grant is an adequate grant. And I want to make sure that it's clear that I feel that we need to bifurcate those issues, that they're not related issues. You know, I think we have an obligation as leaders in this state to make sure that we care for Oregonians. And if we look at where our rising costs are in our state budgets as we sit on the Human Services Subcommittee, you know, are the cost of providing health care to individuals and quality health care to individuals across the state. 70% of the cost of health care is related to personnel, and it's a basic supply and demand question. There is not an adequate supply of physical bodies who are well-trained to provide that service. We're only going to be able to stem our costs for healthcare in the state for what we're paying unless we invest on the front end by providing the supply of adequately trained, properly trained healthcare professionals, whether it be doctors, nurses, CNAs, dentists, whatever the case may be.
Mr. Chair. Senator Duncan's been patient over there.
Well, no, I had decided not to explain my vote because everybody else was, but now I am going to explain my vote. I really think that I'm going to vote for it, reluctantly in a sense. I think there's something we need to keep in mind when we talk about the Oregon Health Science Center. I think oftentimes people think it's just the, the school up on the hill in Portland and so forth. And I've made this comment in some of our committees. The Health and Human Services Committee made a tour around the state looking at rural health issues last summer. And Southern Oregon, and Senator Trow was on that trip too. We had a chance to see firsthand. It was interesting because I don't think we asked the question. I don't think there was a community that we were in that people didn't talk about the impact of the Oregon Health Science Center. And I had not realized that. I mean, I realize you provide doctors and you provide nurses and so forth. But actually, the field impact and the services that they provide out there are just absolutely overwhelming. And many of those local hospitals were saying they really couldn't survive without the help that they get from the Oregon Health Science Center. And I've commented, I said, you know, those of us have been around for a while. A few years back, you know, people were saying, how can we get rid of the medical school at that time, as they're talking about. But this has an impact when we talk about the One Oregon. It really has an Oregon impact. And I think we should be keeping that in mind, and I hope we can do as much as we can in the bonding. I know there's some concern about the timing, too, moving into a next biennium, and I think you're going to be working on that. But I would love to be able to see the $10 million back in there, but I don't know how that's going to happen. So I will vote yes as a support to the medical school, but certainly I share the concern of those who have brought to the attention that we're really dipping into the program that has a major impact on the people of Oregon, not just in the metropolitan area.
Thank you, Senator. Representative Hill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just to comment, I only want to disagree with my colleague from Medford, only to the extent that we're crafting the bonding package such that in the future the benefits and the upside of that research is going to flow back to help support basic healthcare needs and help provide a stream of dollars from the technology transfer that will result from that investment back to provide a base support for the healthcare. So in terms of we're trying to craft a package on the bonding side that immediately, you know, from the facilities perspective, it may have an immediate impact, but from a practical sense in terms of program, it will not. But long term, crafting it such that the state and the taxpayers benefit from the upside of that research in that a specific percentage of the technology transfer flows back in to support basic health care and the core mission of providing health care to Oregonians. And so, I mean, we're trying to balance this out, have a forward look as well, but we, you know, we have a poor choice to make currently, you know, and, you know, in a perfect world, we wouldn't have to make the choice, but it isn't a perfect world.
Okay. Thank you, Representative. Representative Hayden.
Just a question on definitions and procedure, Mr. Chairman. The chairman of the subcommittee has several times referred to this budget as a block grant. And I'm just wondering why is, and on page 2 it says that the income flow, the cash flow to the Oregon Health Sciences University is for fee-for-service grants, gifts, tuition. I'm just curious, why is a grant or a gift presented in a budget format? Is that customary?
Good question.
Yeah. Let staff.
Members, Mr. Co-Chair and members, Oregon Health Sciences University since 1995 has not been a state agency. They have operated as a public corporation, which is the status of some other entities that the state funds. For example, Oregon Public Broadcasting also operates as a public corporation, and what the state does is provide general fund assistance to OHSU to operate their programs, but the legislature does not approve the OHSU budget as you would an agency budget. This money becomes available to the OHSU Board of Directors when they approve the budget for that institution.
And just to follow up, Mr. Chairman and Representative Hayden, all monies expended through the budget by the state have to be in some budget or another. This money goes through the Department of Administrative Services, because that generally is the agency that distributes money to non-state agency entities. But all expenditures have to be reflected in a budget. There are no expenditures that are not in a budget.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And in conclusion, I'd like to declare a potential conflict of interest as a previous faculty member at OHSU Dental.
Thank you, Representative.
Senator Dukes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Every once in a while, I am reminded of the value of discussion in this process, and I want to thank Representative Hill for some prior comments he made to clarify some things that I was not aware of before, and I will be a no.
All righty. Representative Hansen.
I think the issues have been clarified to my satisfaction, too, and I'll be a no also.
I'm going to be a no as well.
Okay. Any further discussion? Let the record show Representative Johnson has declared a potential conflict of interest. And I think we should have a roll call vote on moving Senate Bill 5536 to the Senate floor.
Senator Brown?
No.
Flarno?
Aye.
Duncan?
Aye.
Hartung?
Aye.
Farioli?
Aye.
Duke?
No.
Crow?
No.
Yee?
Aye.
Representative Schrader?
Aye.
Butler?
Aye.
Attridge?
No.
Winters?
Aye.
Hill?
Aye.
Hansen?
No.
Morgan?
Aye.
Hayden?
Aye.
Johnson?
No.
Co-Chair Westland?
Aye.
I thought I could sleep at the switch here.
We got it.
13 ayes.
Thank you. Senate Bill 5536, Oregon Health Sciences University, as amended, is moved to the Senate floor with a B-plus recommendation. Other bills reported out of subcommittee. Senate Bill 397, Senator
Yee. Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. Senate Bill 397 relates to unemployment insurance rate schedule. Senate Bill 397 adjusts and lower tax rates for three of the eight unemployment insurance tax rate schedules in Oregon. The adjustment reduces the impact on employers when the tax system requires moving to one of the modified schedules. These lower taxes will decrease the unemployment insurance trust fund by approximately $10.4 million in 2001 to 2003 and $88.6 million in 2003 to 2005. These decreases will not harm fund solvency and will bring the fund balance down to Oregon's standard of an 18-month reserve. Your Transportation Economic Development Subcommittee recommends approval of Senate Bill 397.
Thank you, Senator. Any questions? Any discussion? Any objections to moving Senate Bill 397 to the Senate floor with due pass recommendation? Any none? So ordered. Senate Bill 512, Representative Patridge.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. Senate Bill 512 directs the Senior and Disabled Services Division to establish a demonstration project to evaluate alternative approaches to licensing and regulating nursing homes. It requires that SDSD apply for a waiver from HCFA for this project and write implementation rules. The bill imposes a $6.50 a bed annual fee upon nursing facilities to pay the state portion of the project cost. In addition, the bill establishes a Senior Consumer Advisory Committee to assess the implementation of the demonstration project. The bill sunsets on June 30, 2005. The demonstration project will allow SDSD to inspect or survey nursing facilities that appear to have chronic problems more often and inspect nursing facilities that have performed well less frequently. In addition, the project would require SDSD to provide more training assistance to nursing facility staff, offer forums for nursing home staff to share information. Your committee recommends approval of Senate Bill 512-G. In addition to the pony, I'd like to add that the industry came in and supported this additional cost. They're looking for some alternative licensing. I thought the best example that was given on this particular bill was the fact that they wanted it more to be treated like OSHA, where they would come in and pre-inspect and actually give people some help instead of kind of coming in and having a punitive effect on just writing people up. And so the industry supports this, and I would ask for your support.
512D. Just checking. I thought I heard D, but you know. Any questions?
Is that my grade for this morning's committee meeting?
Guy gets an A.
All right. I'm trying to keep up with Representative Hansen.
Any discussion? Any objections? Representative Schrader.
Just a concern, Mr. Chair. I'm going to be a no on this budget. There's no need for the additional FTE. I like the waiver. I like the whole approach. But in an agency this size, it's, I think, ridiculous to add four people to do what they should have been doing, quite frankly, all along. There's numerous commissions and other agencies that also facilitate inspection and review of nursing home facilities, and to the extent that they think they need more people to do that, even though, as a representative from Medford's pointed out, they have come forward and willingly assess themselves to pay, I just don't think the agency needs to go there, and quite frankly, the whole Human Resource Division needs to be looking at their personnel. So I'm going to be a no. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative. Any other objections? Any other discussion? Let the record show Representative Schrader is a no vote. See no other objections. Senate Bill 512B is moved to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation. Senate Bill 665. Representative Patrick.
Moving too fast.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. Senate Bill 665A requires a person who applies in person for a photo identification card, driver's permit, or driver's license to write a birth certificate or photo identification before the Department of Transportation replaces the document. Current law requires that applicants for driver's licenses provide proof of address and any other information the Department of Transportation deems necessary. The department believes that the additional requirement will increase workload in field offices throughout the state, equivalent to two positions, to look up digital photos and reject duplicate and replacement transactions that do not have proper identification. The department is expected to develop an implementation plan on all legislation that becomes law. The plan is considered both increases and decreases in workload resulting from the approved legislation. The subcommittee believes that the requirements from this measure can be absorbed within the approved expenditure limitation contained in the department's budget bill, which is Senate Bill 5545. The Transportation Economic Development Subcommittee recommends approval of Senate Bill 665A.
Thank you, Representative. Any questions? Any discussion? Representative.
Right. So, a question of the carrier, if you will, and that I see in the fiscal there's some more positions asked for. I understand from what you just said that would not be necessary.
The committee believed that those would not be necessary. In fact, they believe that this was a highly inflated piece from that's being reported through from Department of Transportation. We believe that they should be able to absorb this within their current budget, just because they're IDing people differently shouldn't increase their workload.
Any further discussion? Representative Hill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm going to be a no. I just think this is a waste of time. I've never quite seen where we have them, where we say in a statute that in addition to whatever they've adopted in rule, they have to have one of these other things. Though, so if this is so important, why don't they just go do it in rule? So I'm a no.
Senator Duke.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. The bill is a good one, but I agree with Representative Patridge. They're going to run into some people who don't come in with it, the photo ID, and so they're going to have to see them again. So there is some expense for that. But it seems to me that it sounds like from the comments in the fiscal that most of the expense is going to come from the fact that we already have pictures of these people on file and we're going to have to look them up. So why don't we not use the technology in this case and just take what they hand us over the counter if it's going to be cheaper? I mean, I'm glad they're absorbing this from within the agency. Perhaps they'll find a way to make it less expensive.
Is that a question or a statement?
Yes, it's a statement.
Representative Johnson.
A question of Representative Patridge. I'm just trying to refresh my memory at the subcommittee level. Did the department come in and testify about the fiscal implications? I don't recall that.
No, but the department did not come in and testify, but the information was provided to the department to Ms. Jordan through LFO, and that's where the numbers were generated from as a result of this. fiscal analysis. But we had some substantial talk in committee about that, and I believe that LFO believes that they wouldn't have made that recommendation otherwise, to absorb it, that they could absorb it from their current budget.
Staff want to comment?
Generally, when we revise a if we disagree with a fiscal, we would revise the fiscal. So that just point of clarification, I'm not for argumentation, but if we don't provide a fiscal unless we agree with it.
Any other discussion?
I just have a question. If we built this out and voted it out without the fiscal dollars in it, or with the fiscal dollars in it?
Representative Patrick? We're voting it out because we believe they can absorb it within their current budget, and there's no intent to go back and redo their budget to accommodate this within their budget bill that already passed. So there will be no additional fiscal or additional position allocation.
Just wanted it clarified for the record.
Absolutely.
Any other discussions? Good. Any other objections? I believe it is Representative Hill. Let the record show Representative Hill is an objection. Seeing no, Senator Hannon is an objection. Seeing no other objections, Senate Bill 665 is passed to the Senate floor with a two-pass recommendation. Senate Bill 817, Senator Clarno.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This bill is a carryover from my 1995 efforts.
And we thought Senator Yee was presenting.
With term limits, I'm sure there's many agencies that check and see which one of you can come back someday. Anyway, Senate Bill 817 comes to you with a unanimous due-pass recommendation from the Senate Public Affairs Committee, whose chair is to my immediate left. The bill sets up an interim committee to look more closely at the thousands of vehicles the state owns and operates. My assistants, along with the Department of Administrative Services and the private sector, have been working the last 5 months to obtain the true costs of operating the state motor pools. This interim committee would be comprised of members from the legislature, representatives from the Department of Administrative Services, and the motor pool folks, along with a representative from labor. The committee would be charged with studying the possible benefits, contracting out a very small portion of the more than 10,000 state vehicles that travel more than 65 million miles every year. In our preliminary observation, it appears the state could save more than $5 a day on every car they rent, multiplied by just 200 cars out of the 10,000, and 250 work days a year would equal $250,000 in savings. Department of Administrative Services supports the bill. One of the things we did find and clarify with the assistance of the private sector was that instead of the $15 a day our state motor pool estimates the cost of leasing a car to another agency, we now are at $40 a day, a more accurate and realistic figure. I really want to thank publicly the folks in the private sector, the people that came down from Portland, from Enterprise and Budget Car Rentals, agencies that helped us on many, many meetings to clarify what we really need to compute as to know our true cost. And I also want to compliment Mr. Dugan Petty and Mr. Bill Brawley of the Department of Administrative Services, who have worked closely with us, and I will appreciate an aye vote.
Thank you, Senator. Among your many supporters of this bill on this specific committee, I can see one of the biggest supporters is Representative Schrader. He's written all kinds of glowing reports, little notes on his measure. Any further discussion? Representative Hayden.
Mr. Chairman, although it's not an issue today, I just want to reinforce the fact that was burned into my mind after 12 years on the House Transportation Committee, that the point-to-point transportation offered by cars, by vehicles, is the most efficient form of transportation available to us. Nothing else compares. Air travel doesn't compare because of the costs of renting taxis and so on. Train travel doesn't compare. It is the most efficient way to move a state employee from point A to point B. If we can make it more economical, as this may do, I'm all for it. But the system is working. It is not broken. I am an aye vote, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Representative. Any further discussion? Any further questions? Any objections to moving Senate Bill 817A to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation? Seeing none, so ordered. House Bill 2082. Representative Winters.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. The Human Services Subcommittee recommends the Joint Committee on Ways and Means report House Bill 2082 with the dash 8 amendments to the Senate with due pass recommendation. Oregon has many successful community learning centers in place. Community learning centers can include community schools, 21st century schools, lighted schools, family resource centers, and other local efforts. If successful, they bring together children, their families, neighborhood leaders, recreation, health care, child care, faith-based organizations, service clubs, and businesses. Not every community has such a center, however. This bill establishes a framework and infrastructure to help expand and sustain community learning centers throughout Oregon. This bill encourages, but does not require, local school districts, commission on children and families, and other partner organizations to develop community learning centers. It directs the Department of Education, the Department of Human Services, the State Commission on Children and Families, and the Oregon Criminal Justice Commission to support the development and implementation of community learning centers. This bill calls for training and technical assistance and assessment of the feasibility of a statewide evaluation of the center's effectiveness. This bill does not add new funding for community learning centers. Dash 8 amendments made the bill non-fiscal, with the affected agencies to provide support as possible within available funding. The Legislative Fiscal Office will report to the Emergency Board in the interim on existing budgeted resources that have been awarded to community learning centers. The subcommittee recommends your approval of House Bill 2082 as amended.
Thank you, Representative. Questions, Senator Brown?
Thanks. A couple of questions for the carrier. As I read this, it looks like the Department of Education only needs to evaluate if they have funding available, and I guess in the event they don't have funding available, how will any evaluation or accountability be done?
Well, as you noted, we removed any fiscal impact. We had a lot of discussion in our committee about the involvement of the Department of Ed. In fact, the probably more the lack of involvement of the Department of Ed in working with the Commission on Children and Families and others who should be at the table in this particular coordinated effort. We did not put a fiscal impact for them. It's encouraging them to do what we believe that they should do.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Follow up?
Nah.
Mr. Chair.
Well, that response is about as exciting as...
No, thank you, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Chair, let me take it from there.
Yeah, yeah. Senator Duncan.
I think you're going to find the Department of Ed is going to be very responsive to this now.
I
don't generally speak for them. But
my sense as well, I think they welcome the bill.
They heard our comments, and they did arrive at the subcommittee. I think they were watching the video as we were discussing this issue, and so they did come and said that they would work with the other agency.
Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm not familiar with all of the programs that are going on statewide, but I am somewhat familiar with the Sun Schools that are occurring in the Portland metro area. There's a great deal of evaluation that's built into the Sun School project. It's primarily grant funding that supports it. There's evaluations that are going on. I think maybe the role of the Department of Education will be more to advise in ways to make sure that the evaluations from these many of these different places become compatible and more to coordinate the evaluations that's going on rather than to actually go out and have to do the hands-on evaluation. So it may not be a huge financial burden on them to work at that level.
Thank you, Representative. Any further questions? Any further discussion? Any NAS? Seeing none. House Bill 2082, as amended, is moved to the Senate floor with a do pass recommendation. Thank you, Representative Brown.
Senator Brown. And Representative.
Yeah. House Bill 2150, Senator Dukes.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. House Bill 2150 changes the fees assessed by the Department of Environmental Quality on cargo vessels, tank vessels, and onshore and offshore facilities for the Oil Spill Prevention Fund. The bill increases the fee on cargo vessels from $25 to $48 per trip and on non-self-propelled tank vessels from $28 to $42 per trip. Under current law, fees for self-propelled tank vessels and for offshore and onshore facilities were set by the Environmental Quality Commission through a rule not to exceed $153,600 per year for all facilities and vessels. House Bill 2150 changes these fees by statutorily setting the fee for self-propelled tank vessels from 300 gross tons or less at $42 per trip, for self-propelled tank vessels over 300 gross tons at $836 per trip, and for all offshore and onshore facilities at $4,500 per year. Revenues from these fees are used by the Department as cost recovery for reviewing the marine oil spill contingency plans required by law and for conducting training and response exercises and other activities related to the preparation and review of contingency plans. The details of the bill were developed in a collaborative process and are supported by the affected industry groups. The Natural Resources Subcommittee amended the bill by adding other funds expenditure limitation of $208,280 related to the restoration of 1.25 FTE in the Department's Marine Oil Spill Preparedness and Prevention Program. With the additional revenue, the program will operate with a total of 3.35 FTE during the 2001-03 biennium. The Natural Resources Subcommittee recommends approval of House Bill 2150 as amended.
Thank you, Senator. Any questions? Any discussions? Any objections? Seeing none, House Bill 2050 is moved to the House floor with a two-pass recommendation. House Bill 2200, Representative Morgan.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. House Bill 2200 authorizes the state forester to enter into agreements with non-federal forest landowners as a way to market, register, transfer, or sell forestry carbon offsets on behalf of the landowner in order to provide a stewardship incentive for non-federal forest lands. A forestry carbon offset is defined as a transferable certificate or note representing a measured amount of carbon dioxide sequestered and stored on healthy forest lands. The bill directs the Department of Forestry to develop an accounting system for the sale or transfer of offsets using accepted principles and standards relating to the measurement of carbon offset as mitigation for carbon dioxide emissions. The bill also directs the State Board of Forestry to develop the administrative rules defining the principles and standards with the assistance of an advisory committee. House Bill 2200 requires that the proceeds from the transfer or sale of forest carbon offsets be distributed to the non-federal forest landowner and to the department for use in administering the carbon offset program and to fund programs providing assistance to non-industrial private forest landowners. The fiscal impact of the rule development and program implementation in the 2001-03 biennium will be absorbed in the agency's base budget. Revenues from the sale of the carbon offsets are anticipated to cover the program's expenditures starting in the 03-05 biennium. The Natural Resources Subcommittee recommends approval of House Bill 2200A.
Questions? Representative Hill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm trying to understand, this is just marketing, allowing the state forester to market the carbon offset which already exists, or are we creating the market, the carbon offsets?
The Mr. Co-Chair, Representative Hill, the program already exists, but the state of Oregon is not involved in it, and this allows the state of Oregon to become involved in the program.
Follow-up. does this then allow the state to take lands in the state forest and defer harvesting timber? If the state land board decides the Tillamook Forest, they're going to sell all the carbon offsets, therefore they wouldn't harvest it?
I will defer this question to our staff.
Mr. Chair, Representative, that particular issue did not come up in the discussions of the committee. From a practical sense, would this allow the state land board to take state forest land and sell carbon offsets and therefore take state forests out of production for the period of the carbon offsets?
Mr. Chair, Representative, if I could confer with the expert for a moment, I could answer that for you.
Mr. Chair, would you have him identify the expert? I don't know who's advising us.
Forestry Department.
Is it Forestry Department?
Looks like.
Okay.
Mr. Morocco, could you identify?
Mr. Chair, I was conferring with Jim Cathcart of the Department of Forestry, who manages the Forest Resource Trust Program. According to Mr. Cathcart, when the Board of Forestry developed plans for the state forests, they considered the possibility of using carbon offsets in that plan, and this would not change the way they intend to manage the forest, because the plans included the possibility of using portions of that for offsets.
Follow-up. But the practical effect of selling a carbon offset on state forest land would bet that, if I'm understanding and reading this bill correctly, is that that land would, those trees would not be harvestable, because you're selling the ability to transfer carbon dioxide, and, so you could not cut those trees down for the period of the carbon offset.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hill, that's correct. However, the proceeds from doing that would also be available for distribution.
Mr. Chair, I'll be a no on this bill.
Mr. Chair. Senator Dukes.
Thank you, Mr. Kocher. I just wanted to remind people, for whatever it's worth, that most of those state forest lands are tied up with trust deeds between the counties and the state, and that those trust deeds, in most instances, require that the forests be managed for financial return to the districts in which they're harvested. So it's unlikely that the state would risk putting something into a program like this that would not yield the same or better financial return that they would get from harvesting the timber, because if they did, they'd be in court with the counties and the districts.
Excellent comments, Senator. Any further discussions?
Sure.
Senator Troll.
Thank you. I was wondering, we have not been involved in doing this before as a state. The state has not been involved. Why is it in the state's interest to set up this program and do this?
The program basically is a wonderful springboard to bring underdeveloped forest lands up to a higher level of development, and also for private landowners that have, for various different reasons, the necessity of leaving their trees on the stump on the ground. This provides them with a way to realize income without actually having to cut their trees. It is also a source of income into the Department of Forestry and the programs that that department supports.
Are there any downsides, Representative?
Again, I would get back to the point that was raised by Representative Hicks, and I think Senator Dukes did a good job of outlining criteria that the department manages their timber on, and that is that they are bound to return the highest amount that they can to the school fund. And so I think that that would be a decision that would be paramount as they undertook whether to actually apply this to their own lands. The discussion in the committee revolved more around the positive impact that this would have on private forest lands and also the trading process that would be set up so that, for example, power plants that were wanting to be established could use this program to offset the polluting impact that they would have by purchasing credits from this program.
Further questions? Representative Hill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My concern is not for the good purposes, is that this is not limited. The Tillamook Forest is coming into production, and one could argue that, you know, selling off the carbon offsets brings money into the common school fund, but that doesn't necessarily give anybody jobs. Produce an economic activity. There's been a huge investment in that area by the state and by the communities, and it's now coming to a point where it can be rationally harvested in a prudent manner. And my concern is that this program is not limited, and the state land board could decide to go off and sell off the carbon offsets. And with the program not being limited, I think that's a little bit broad and takes a too much timber, the risk of too much timber being taken out of production at a time when it could be brought into production. I know.
Senator Dix.
Just one point of clarification, Mr. Co-Chair. The money from the Fillmore Burn is not part of the Common School Fund. You have the Elliott State Forest, which is managed by the Division of State Lands, and the resources from there do go to the Common School Fund. And I think there's one other small parcel that does as well. But most of the state forest land, the money is returned to the agency that manages the forest and to the taxing districts within it. Representative Hill makes a good point that this could, if taken to considerable lengths, have an impact upon some of the timber available, but in the whole big scheme of things, the decision on state forest land will be in conjunction with the local county commissioners, or again, the Department of Forestry will be in court. So, I mean, the statutes tie this all up pretty handily, so it will be in the county's best interests where those things are located, or it won't happen.
Senator Ferriello.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, the line of questioning brought up by Representative Hill is interesting and a good area for us to be concerned about. This could become as fine a little boondoggle as ever existed in the state of Oregon. However, and the other concern I think that I have in addition is that these air quality enhancers, carbon sequestering, will have little value unless and until the U.S. develops a comprehensible air quality strategy that has congressional support, because unless you've got some sort of a demand out there, a sustainable demand for pollution tax credits or carbon sequestering or a number of these other things, you're just not going to have a lot of value in these in the creation of these this program and the product, which is in fact tradable certificates. But there are some values that we haven't talked about. In air quality control, everyone I think has heard the problem that the 98% of air quality standard can be met with existing technology and relatively inexpensively. The other 2% that kills you. And we heard discussion in the subcommittee that people that need to show air quality, especially carbon reductions, can show that reduction using this kind of a strategy. So the last 2% cost using this mitigation strategy can be comparable with the other 98%. In other words, it lowers the cost of removing carbon from the atmosphere. But in fact, what Oregon really needs in addition to this program and the vigilance of this legislature, because I don't want to see this program go crazy, is a comprehensive strategy for mitigation banking. We do not have one. We have the Division of State Lands, Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife, Oregon Watershed Enhancement Board, Oregon Department of Forestry, and Water Resources Department, to name a few, all looking at different strategies for mitigation. And there is no central clearinghouse for mitigation banking. There's no strategy for converting mitigation between natural resource elements like air, water, land. In the meantime, we're doing wetlands mitigation, watershed mitigation, pollution control tax credits, conservation easements, tax incentives for various pollution reductions and controls, and access and habitat management programs across a wide spectrum of agencies. This is yet another strategy, a new one, you know, one that's probably based on a 30-year-old strategy, which is air quality management. But Oregon should, if it's going to get into this area, have some comprehensive mitigation banking strategy with an agency designated as the central clearinghouse that can develop tools that would convert mitigation from one area of natural resource management to another so that these mitigation strategies would be universally applicable. I hope at some point in time the state of Oregon, acting through the legislature or through the governor's office, does decide that there will be a comprehensive mitigation banking strategy. This would be an excellent piece of that strategy.
Good comment, Senator. Representative Butler.
Thank you. Just a question to Carrier. I'm not that familiar with the overall complex issue of carbon offset. If you sell your carbon offset from a forest and it burns down, and the current drought we have, what happens? Is it recapturable?
To the good representative from Eastern Oregon, we are talking about a renewable resource here, right. So I think in those situations you would replant.
A lot of carbon.
I hope that in rulemaking it would address those kinds of situations.
Thank you. Just concerned about the drought in which we find ourselves in Southern Oregon right
now. Fair comment. Representative Hayden.
Mr. Chairman, I was on the subcommittee that heard this, and I heard it with some interest, and I'm enthusiastic in my support of it. I would comment to the committee that this is an early generation, that these are early days, and there will be many problems that will arise with this, and many solutions will be developed. But I view this as a catalyst. And the good senator from Eastern Oregon said that there should be a number of these in different agencies, and this might be a catalyst to stimulate further efforts in this area. The representative makes a good point when he asks about selling the carbon offsets from state lands. Now, I asked a similar question in committee. There being 30 million acres of forest land in the state of Oregon, is that enough to handle the entire demand for carbon offsets, or do we have to plant more land? State land is a very small proportion of the total forest land, very, very small proportion. So it's unlikely that that they would be able to underbid or outbid the private landowners in the state. But it's something that should be considered. And I did ask the question about the forest burning down and if that did release all the carbon. And there was some discussion about that. And I asked the question as to whether young trees or older trees would capture carbon more quickly. And the answer wasn't entirely clear, but it's my feeling that younger trees do capture the carbon more quickly. So replanting burned down forests or planting undeveloped land would be an important thing. And that would be something that would be good for the state of Oregon, not only for the carbon offset, but to plant more trees. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Any further discussion? Any questions? Good discussion, committee. Any objections other than Representative Hill? Representative Winters? Let the record show Representative Winters. Seeing no other objections. House Bill 2200, as amended, is sent to the floor of the House with a do-pass recommendation. So ordered. House Bill 2264, Representative Morgan.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. The
Ways and Means Committee is going to hear a couple of tank bills next and just kind of differentiate between them. The first one that I'm going to be talking about are underground storage tanks that are in gas stations. House Bill 2264 modifies and establishes certain fees related to the Department of Environmental Quality's regulation of underground storage tanks. The bill also directs the department to submit an application to the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency to obtain final authorization for the state's underground storage tank program. The bill increases the annual fee paid by underground storage tank permit holders to $85 per tank and establishes new fees of $400 for a new tank installation permit and $70 for a permit modification. Service provider license fees are raised to $300 per year, and service provider supervisor fees are increased to $150 every 2 years. House Bill 2264 also provides for a one-time $20 surcharge on tank permits issued in calendar year 2002. The bill sunsets the annual tank permit fee effective at the end of calendar year 2005. Revenues from these fees are used by the department to protect groundwater and land from leaking tanks. The underground storage tank program is federally mandated, and the department conducts the education and inspection program on all retail petroleum storage tanks. The details of the bill, including the setting of the fees, were developed in a collaborative process and are supported by the affected industry groups. The Natural Resources Subcommittee amended the bill by adding other funds expenditure limitation for the $718,943 related to the establishment of five positions, which are actually 4.38 FTE, in the department's underground storage tank program. Of the positions added by the bill, 2.63 FTE represent restoration of positions lost by the agency due to revenue shortfalls. Two new positions are phased in during the 2001-03 biennium, and one limited duration position is added for 18 months. The Natural Resources Subcommittee recommends approval of House Bill 2264 as amended.
Any questions?
Any clarification?
Representative Butler.
Thank you. The per permit modification, the fee on that, was it 70 or 75?
$70 is what I have in my notes. Mr. Rocco, could you confirm that?
Madam Chair, Mr. Chair, Representative Butler, I believe that should be $75. It's in Section 12, subsection 2.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Any further questions?
I just have one question.
Representative Winters?
Your limited duration position, which was not a position, as I understand it, was not included in the governor's policy package. What was the committee's discussion as to why that position was needed?
Mr. Rocco, could you assist with this?
Mr. Chair, Representative Winters, that position is there to assist with the implementing this pilot project that's in Section 13, and that was not included in the original budget proposal, and that's the reason for the $20 surcharge would be to provide the funding for that. That limited duration position. That surcharge is only effective for calendar year 2002, and then it goes away.
Any further questions? Further discussion? Any objections to moving House Bill 2264A to the House floor with a due pass recommendation? Let the record show Representative Schrader is a no. Any no other objections? So ordered. House Bill 2883, Representative Morris.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. This bill relates to heating oil tanks that people find buried in their backyards. House Bill 2883 modifies and establishes certain fees related to the Department of Environmental Quality's heating oil program. The program provides for certification of voluntary decommissioning of heating oil tanks and approval of corrective action taken by a service provider on heating oil tanks. The bill continues a $50 fee on individuals requesting certification of a heating oil tank decommissioning and raises the fee for requesting certification of a heating oil tank corrective action from $50 to $125. Revenues from these fees are used by the department for contractor licensing and audits, data management, homeowner notification, project review, and enforcement of the heating oil tank program. The department has experienced an increase in the number of leaking tank reports with the full implementation of the program. The details of the bill, including the setting of the fees, were developed in a collaborative process and are supported by the affected industry groups. The Natural Resources Subcommittee amended the bill by adding other funds expenditure limitation for $244,049 related to the restoration of 1.5 FTE in the department's heating oil tank decommissioning program. With the additional revenue, the program will continue to operate with a total of 4 FTE during the 01-03 biennium. The Natural Resources Subcommittee recommends approval of House Bill 2883 as amended.
Thank you, Representative. Any questions? Any discussion? Representative Hill.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. There'd be a no on this. This is one of the worst run programs, and I don't see anything that's going to affect it. I've had so many of my constituents have problems and a nightmare when they have taken a tank out trying to get the certificates, and they're in the middle of trying to sell their house, and the agency, you know, has lost the paperwork, and they just can't seem to find it anymore. They've done multiple submissions of the exact same data to them. It's just absolutely atrocious, and I don't see anything in here in terms of what's going to improve it, and so I'm going to be a no on that.
Well, Representative Morgan?
Mr. Chair, if I might address the good representative from Hillsborough's comments. Those issues were definitely brought forward in the subcommittee, and our hope is that by beefing the program up somewhat, we can speed up the turnaround time. The committee heard a lot of testimony about how we were actually, or the department was impeding sales of homes because people couldn't get the certification on the heating oil tanks, and the committee was very sensitive to trying to speed that up.
Thank you, Representative. Any further questions? Any further discussions? Representative Hill is a no. Representative Schrader is a no. Representative Winters is a no.
I'm a no.
Senator Yee is a no. Any further objections? Seeing none, House Bill 2883, as amended, is moved to the House floor with a due pass recommendation. House Bill 3441, Senator Hannon.
Yes, Mr. Co-Chair, members, House Bill 3441 diverts a portion of unemployment insurance taxes to generate revenue for the Jobs Plus program. The Joint Committee on Ways and Means in the House of Representatives has already previously passed this bill. The amendment that is included in the bill needs to be adopted to reflect a change in the unemployment tax schedules that the bill uses as a base for the diversion surtax. These tax schedules were modified by the passage of Senate Bill 397, which was passed out this morning, earlier action by the full Ways and Means Committee. The amendment replaces the current diversion schedules in the bill with the schedules based on Senate Bill 397.
Thanks,
recommend approval of the conflict amendments, House Bill 3441.
Thank you, Senator. Any discussion? Representative Hanson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I spoke against the Jobs Plus program. A couple other vehicles, and I've rode that horse as far as I can ride it. This is the financial vehicle to accomplish a substantive issue, to put into effect a substantive issue that I disagree with, but I can't see anything wrong with the financial vehicle to get it in play.
So you're not only a yes, you're a resounding yes?
No, I'm quiet yet.
Quiet yet. We'll take that as a step in the right direction. Any further?
Sure.
Senator Phil.
I think we're going to be a yes, too, but I think we really believe that the Jobs Plus program is one that is not nearly as good as the Jobs program, and if we were spending more money to expand a program, we would spend it there rather than the Jobs Plus.
Thank you, Senator. Any further comments? Any objections? Let the record show Representative Schrader is no. Seeing no other objections, House Bill 3441 is with the conflict amendments, is moved to the Senate floor with a do pass recommendation. House Bill 3759, Senator Yee.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. House Bill 3759-A relates to unemployment compensation for dislocated workers. House Bill 3759-A provides supplemental unemployment insurance benefits for eligible dislocated workers who are attending professional training. Among other criteria for eligibility, a worker would have to be unemployed due to high energy costs, extended drought conditions, and the attendant economic conditions, secondary effects of foreign trade, or a shift of production for another state or territory of the United States. The Employment Department anticipates that almost 1,200 eligible workers will receive up to 26 weeks of additional benefits. The estimated cost is approximately $12.5 million in payments from the Unemployment Insurance Trust Fund. These payments should not change projected unemployment insurance tax schedules or increase employer taxes. The program would run only for 2001 to 03 biennium. Members have heard previously that the rate for unemployment insurance payment would be reduced for the next 4 years. So there's a savings of $60 million, and $12.5 million will come out of this. So there's no increase in rates. And from Employment Department's information, there's about 10,500 lost jobs during the last 12 months, and about 6,500 lost jobs come from manufacturers' jobs. And during hearing, we heard from unemployed workers saying that they have worked in the same industry, like food processing industry, for 15 to 20 years, and it'll be difficult for them to get re-employed without good training. So this bill helps workers get the training they need and will not increase costs to the employers. So it's a win-win situation, and urge your support.
The Senator, mm-hmm. Representative Patridge.
Mr. Chair, I provided a courtesy vote out of the subcommittee. I will be voting no in this committee. The Employment Department testified that this was based upon what was done with the timber workers when we had such a devastating impact on the timber industry. I asked how effective the program was when it was done for the timber industry by extending these benefits. They said it was less than effective. When asked what kind of programs the people would be retrained in during the 26-week training program, they could not identify what the 26-week training programs would be to retrain. I think maybe this was appropriate for the timber industry and should have probably been better administrated, but by the same token, that was looking at industry. These are people who are closing down in different jobs related to energy. It's not the closure of an entire industry, so I don't think the necessity to extend benefits for this particular 26-week retraining is justified. They couldn't justify that the program would be effective, and I will be a no vote.
Thank you, Representative. Representative Winters.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. I'm supporting the bill, and just to remind you that here, the agribusiness, where you saw 885 plus displaced workers, some of whom have worked in that industry for a lot of years,
and finding themselves and their families in a position that they didn't even imagine would exist. We do have changing industry that's occurring in our state, and we do have displaced workers, and I think they need that extra time and that training with which to find a way to continue to support their families. So I will be supporting this. I think it's a very good measure, a stopgap measure though it is, but I think it's a necessary one.
Thank you, Representative. Any further discussion? Senator Farioli.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have been bitterly critical of the retraining programs as well. I think they are at best an offer of hope for a few, but when we are looking at some of the history of the retraining programs for the forest manufacturing and related industries, they were not very effective. But I will say, in this instance, I'm certainly going to support this program and this bill. Energy-related layoffs in the Mid-Columbia region are a terrible fact. We have at least 600 workers in Oregon that are connected directly to the aluminum industry. Bonneville Power Administration and others are asking for a 2-year moratorium on power supply to direct service industries in the Mid-Columbia region. It isn't the workers that are directly employed in the aluminum industry that are the probable beneficiaries of these retraining programs, since it's very difficult to retrain someone in the aluminum industry for a job that pays $60,000 a year on average. And that's the jobs that are being displaced by high energy costs. But every dollar that's paid in payroll in the Mid-Columbia recirculates in the community 6 to 7 times. And so the service sector, if we lose these jobs in the Mid-Columbia, the service sector will lose 6 to 7 times the payroll value, which is about $30 million. And those are the jobs that will be lost, and it will be attributable to high energy costs, and those are the folks for whom retraining will be an effective vehicle. And those are the ones that will benefit the most from an extension of the unemployment insurance period. So, you know, we look at the sectors, and we think, well, that's going to take the big hit. We often forget the secondary and tertiary effects in the economy. Those are the folks that need our help right now. So I think this is I'm not wildly enthusiastic about retraining programs that exit train some of our best workers when we really ought to be fighting harder to retain the basic industry. But in the secondary and tertiary markets for labor, we really need to do something to help workers. This is what we ought to do.
Good comment, Senator. Senator Hayden, or Representative Hayden.
I'd just like to comment that a 6-month training program can be very productive. Those who may have served in the armed forces will know that the armed forces are able to put together programs within 3 to 6 months can give you incredible skills. Now, it may be that the programs that are available in the civilian counterpart are not as effective. That's not the fault of the timing. 6 months is enough for people to learn. For example, you could run a whole legislative session in 6 months if you so chose.
Doesn't mean we learned anything.
Thank you, Representative. Any further comments?
For the carrier, just a technical question. While some of the plants have closed down, there are some that are going to be paying, in my understanding anyway, BPA, or they actually, because of the arrangements and that have been made, that some of the plants will still continue to pay the workers even though they're no longer working or employed there. Would they be eligible for these benefits, or would there be some provision that if you're still getting payment from your previous employer that you would not be eligible?
I would defer this to
Mr. Co-Chair, Representative Schrader. My understanding is that as long as employees were receiving a paycheck still, they would not be eligible for unemployment insurance compensation.
Question of LFO, I believe, if I may. Is it true that these plants where employees have been laid off because there's no energy available, and the company claims that they are paying them their full wages, but doesn't the state pay the unemployment part, and then the company finishes it off to their level?
Mr. Co-Chair, Senator Hartung, I'm not real sure how those payments to employees are made by the under those arrangements. But as long as those payments were being like considered salary, and the employer was still paying unemployment insurance taxes, I do not believe that under current law those employees would be considered as eligible for unemployment insurance compensation.
Does anybody know? I think they are being paid unemployment.
Mr. Chair, I believe, and Ms. Grossley is here, but I believe that wages which are paid under this kind of an arrangement are not subject to unemployment tax because they're not subject to employment. They are subject to Social Security, but they are not. I don't believe that they're subject to the actual taxation itself.
Well, I understand that, but my question was, you know, for instance, a $60,000
being just supplemented.
It draws unemployment first, and then the company finishes it off.
I don't know the answer to that.
I haven't heard that.
I think we're trying to.
We're getting clarification.
Just one other item, Mr. Chair. Relative to the training, I would like to, as amended, this issue will address a technical training as has previously been approved as well. So the training which, if it has been in the early years, I understand there's some concerns that it may have been less than efficient. I think that we have improved our training programs, and these are as approved by the department.
Thank you. I believe we have a more comprehensive answer.
I don't know, Mr. Co-Chair, Senator Hartung, information from the department indicates that these wages are still subject to unemployment insurance compensation, although it's kind of a standby pay as opposed to for actively coming into work, but it's still considered a normal form of wage or salary compensation, so it would be subject to tax still. And the employees would not be considered eligible for unemployment insurance because they're not technically unemployed.
Maybe this is not the place to talk about it, but I still don't have an answer to my question. My understanding is that the people that are, you know, laid off and the company says they're being paid their full salary, isn't the first part of that salary that's paid unemployment compensation?
Mr. Co-Chair, Senator Hartung, I don't believe so. I believe they're still getting full payment from the employer under that scenario.
Okay, thank you.
Senator Farrioli.
Mr. Chairman, thank you. I think the interesting feature here is that there's no obligation by the employer to pay these workers, and that some of the companies have chosen not to pay their workers. And in fact, those folks are just displaced workers. Others who have indicated a long-term commitment to the industry and to the employers are taking payments from Bonneville Power Administration for the sale of the power allocated to the direct service industries and paying the wages of the workers for a couple of reasons. Most importantly of which is to keep their highly qualified, well-trained workforce together against the day, we hope within 6 months, when available energy will allow the restart of those pipelines. So I think it's interesting and commendable to note that there are Oregon employers who are Oregon-based companies who have continued to pay their workers when other regional or nationally based companies have kicked the plug and walked. So I think when you talk about the infrastructure, it is not a monolith, and we have some Oregon-based employers who essentially are leading the league in the care and cooperation with their workforce. It's a very unusual situation and one that deserves a little more scrutiny. Thank you.
Thank you, Senator. Okay, moving right along. Any further discussion?
I'd like to acknowledge Representative Hayden's remark that the session is 6 months long. I think this committee is let Representative Patridge be recorded as a no. Any other objections? Seeing none, House Bill 3759, as amended, is reported out to the House with a due pass recommendation. House Bill 3956, Representative Morgan.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. House Bill 3956 requires the Department of Environmental Quality to develop and implement a pollutant reduction trading program as a way of achieving water quality objectives and standards. The bill requires the department to develop the program in compliance with all state and federal water quality regulations and in a manner to promote economic efficiencies. Pollutant reduction trading occurs when a business or government that is meeting pollutant reduction standards further reduces pollution output. The extra reduction results in a credit that can be sold or traded to another company or government unit that might be unable to reduce its own pollution in a cost-efficient manner. The Department of Environmental Quality has been studying pollutant reduction trading or effluent trading over the past year but has not yet implemented a program. House Bill 3956 directs the department to seek federal grant funds to establish the program and authorizes the department to assess reasonable fees for administration costs once the program is established. The Natural Resources Subcommittee amended the bill by eliminating a section appropriating general fund as a federal grant match. The department has prepared a grant application to the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency in the amount of $200,000 for the development of a pollutant reduction trading program that does not require matching funds. The Natural Resources Subcommittee recommends approval of House Bill 3956 as amended.
Thank you, Representative. Any further questions? Any discussion? Any objections to moving House Bill 3956 as amended to the House floor with a due pass recommendation? Seeing none, so ordered. House Bill 3996. House Bill 3996. Representative Schrader.
House Bill 3996A would transfer $2 million currently in the Law Enforcement Medical Liability Account, LEMLA, to the General Fund after June 30th, 2001. LEMLA pays medical care providers for the cost of treating persons who are injured while being apprehended by the police. The account is funded through an assessment added to criminal fines. During the 9901 biennium, account revenue is expected to be $1.8 million, and claims and management expenses are estimated to be only $440,000. Fund balance is expected to grow from $1.5 million at the beginning of the biennium to $2.9 million at the end of the 01 biennium. Both the governor's revised budget and the co-chair's budgets include the $2 million transferred from LEMLA. So we urge your approval.
Thank you, Representative Schrader. Good read. Any questions?
Representative Carey.
Representative Hayden.
Representative, are the payments made in addition to private insurance that the apprehendees may have if private insurance first goes?
I believe these are primarily uninsured.
But, I think it's but if not?
I guess I'd ask LFO.
Mr. Co-Chair and Representative Hayden, my understanding is that these people are not otherwise insured. No.
Mr. Chairman, the question is, if they have private medical insurance, is it first billed before the providers are paid from the state funds?
They don't have private insurance.
No criminal has private insurance?
Those people would not be reimbursed. If they have private insurance, they would not be reimbursed out of these funds.
The providers?
The providers would be assuming the providers would be paid for out of their own private insurance if they had it.
Mr. Co-Chair and Representative Hayden, if one of these persons was privately insured, my belief is that if they were being pursued by police and hurt while being pursued by the police, that their private insurance might not cover them at all. So even if they are covered, their coverage does not probably include coverage while being pursued by the police. Like,
they're not, they're funny people.
Mr. Chairman, as I see there's some doubt about this, I yield the floor.
Yeah, this comedy show is brought to you by I think it's well stated, though, actually. Senator Farioli.
Will the carrier yield to a question, Mr. Chairman?
I'm sure he will.
In the incidence of a career criminal who's injured while on the job.
Thank you.
We are moving right along.
Well, that would include legislators, too, at that time.
Any further discussion, questions? Seeing none, any objections to moving House Bill 3996 to the House floor with a due pass recommendation? Seeing none, so ordered. Other business, Department of Human Services. Looks like we have a timely and appropriate grant application. Is that correct, Senator Yee?
It's timely. The deadline is June 20th. Mr. Co-Chair, the Human Services Subcommittee recommends the Joint Committee on Ways and Means approve submission of a federal grant application in the amount of $325,000 annually for up to 3 years to identify and evaluate intervention strategies for children with fetal alcohol syndrome and alcohol-related neurodevelopmental disorders, ARND. The grant application is due June 20th, 2001. There's no matching fund requirement or ongoing funding commitment. The State Office for Services to Children and Families would use the grant funds to improve its ability to diagnose and serve children with FAS, that's fetal alcohol-related syndrome, and ARND to increase the chance of staying safely in their own homes or maintaining foster care or adoptive placement. About $250,000 of the grant would pay for a contractor to provide training and individualized interventions for a selected group of children, their parents, and other persons with who interact with them, such as teachers and therapists. Early estimates are that about 75 children will receive therapeutic interventions. The outcomes achieved with intervention and training will be evaluated against outcomes for other FAS-ARND children, SCF SERF. Services for Children and Families expect to use about $75,000 of the grant for research evaluation by Portland State University. Your committee strongly recommends approval.
Thank you, Senator. Representative Hayden.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I apologize for my loquaciousness today, but we often hear it said in this body that if we do this, we'll save money later. And this is an example. To its credit, some years ago, the legislature addressed the problem of fetal alcohol syndrome and posted in every restaurant in the state a sign that says, pregnancy and alcohol do not mix. This was to address fetal alcohol syndrome. Had the legislature not done that, this grant application would be much larger now. We have, in fact, saved money and many minds and many lives by doing that. So I commend the legislative body on their early preventive strike against fetal alcohol syndrome.
Good. I think the record should show that Representative Hayden was instrumental in that very visionary piece of legislation. So thank you, Representative, and his point is absolutely well taken. Mm-hmm. Any further questions?
Okay.
Senator Brown.
Mr. Chair, just to be brief for your post-session reading, if any of you are interested in the subject, there's two actually very well-written books. One is by Craig Leslie, Oregonian, actually a Portlander, called Storm Riders, and the other is Michael Doris's The Unbroken Cord, both of them very well-written and extremely frightening. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Senator Dukes.
Mr. Co-Chair, I guess to the agency, one of the primary experts on FAS is located in Portland, and I hope that we will make use of what is already available and not attempt to reinvent what has been done. Oregon, I think, has been seriously lacking in its attention to this area, and I'm delighted that we're going to move forward.
Good. Any further comments? Before everybody runs off, we've got a couple announcements here. Any
Any further comments, questions? Any objections to the approval of the grant application? Seeing none, so ordered. Okay, now Peggy, make sure I do this correctly. All the morning subs are meeting right now.
When we adjourn.
Except education.
They meet at 1:30.
Right, not this morning.
Maybe you should just read the schedule as you've got it.
Okay, public safety meets in H-170. It has four work sessions, four bills to work session. Human services meets in this room with a couple of grant applications. Transportation and Economic Development Subcommittee meets at 10 o'clock. H-174 has a work session. And then the Education Subcommittee meets this afternoon in this room at 1:30.
And Senator Hannon, who had to excuse himself to the governor's office, will be chairing public safety. So if he is not there when you proceed to 170, please be patient. Because he will be showing up summarily.
Okay.
And Senator Brown is giving me some hand signals.
Do we know what the schedule looks like for tomorrow, Mr. Chair, for other folks who have...
We do.
Please schedule activities.
Human Services Subcommittee will meet at 9 o'clock tomorrow. The Special Capital Construction Lottery and Bonding Subcommittee will also meet at 9 o'clock. And then the Education Subcommittee will meet at 1 o'clock.
As will 1 o'clock?
At 1 o'clock.
And Transportation... Economic Development at 1 o'clock, according to Mike's schedule earlier.
Okay, that's not on this schedule, but I'll... I'll double check.
let the record show Peggy has made her first error today. You are meeting.
Yeah, I'm passing on an error.
Yeah, that's right. Somebody else is here.
Okay, as we all know, it gets a little frenetic, a little chaotic in the last days of session, and we have entered that period. So be very sensitive to schedules and schedule changes. Senator Farioli.
Conference Committee on House Bill 2281 at 10 o'clock this morning. That would involve... Senators Beyer, Farioli, and Starr, Representative Shetterly, Kefauri, and Williams.
Representative Butler, thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. I ask that we suspend the rules and allow me to vote on House Bill 3441. I was out of the room when the vote was taken. I vote aye.
I see no anyone object to allowing Representative Butler to vote. Seeing none, record him as an aye on what? 3441. We can see that we are joined by our august co-chair, so as we leave here, let's proceed to our respective hearing rooms and start. We are adjourned.